Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Tom, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm excited to talk about today's topic and how you got interested in it. Do you mind introducing yourself to everyone out there listening?
Yeah, my name's Tom Cantrell. I've been in Sasquatch research now for 65 years. I started back in 1958 with the Jerry Crew incident in Northern California. It happened in an area that I happen to know very well, and it just caught my attention. I was 15 years old at the time, and if you want to add that up, yes, I'm over 80 years old now.
You look fantastic.
That got me started. Now, my first few years, all I did was read. Actually, first several years, I got out of high school in 61, joined the Navy, and believe me, in the North Atlantic, 300 feet below the surface, there was not much chance to do any boots on the ground Sasquatch investigations. But Navy transferred me to Washington State in 1968, and that's where I was able to get boots on the ground and where my research really started. Prior to that, there were, things that happened to Tom Slick expeditions in Northern California and Dr. Ivan Sanderson, his work. And if you have any interest in the subject, look him up, read what he's written about it. He wrote articles for Argosy and True magazine back in the era, one especially on the Jerry Crew incident, and another on the Patterson-Gimlin film in 67. And he was the foremost paleontologist of the time. He'd written some 13 or 14 books on mammals of the world, which were the standard for teaching mammalogy in the universities. Very learned, very, very knowledgeable man, and full of information. And of course, those articles appeared in magazine like True magazine and Argosy magazine, which were our internet back in the 1950s and early 60s. That's how information was disseminated, was in magazines, especially men's magazines. And then when I got out of the Navy, I stayed on the Olympic Peninsula, started college, and it was during those times that I really started understanding what I was dealing with. My degree was in logging engineering, and as an engineer, I did most of my work was with bridge sites in the state of Washington. If you're going to build a road that crosses a stream used by anadromous fish, as fish that go to sea and then come back to spawn, like salmon, steelhead, and others, you have to have a permit from the state to do that. In order to get that permit, you have to engineer the site, and that's what they would hire me to do. I never worked for a company as an employee, but I did contracts for them, and what I would do is it would be the bridge site. I got the ones that were 5, 6, 7 miles off the road. Their company engineers did the ones next to the road. I had to hike back into old growth timber 5 or 6 miles to get to where the bridge site was going to be for the ones I got the contracts on. But that was no big deal. I
They
could,
made you work twice, man.
yeah, right. And but I learned really quickly, you did not want to hike in, do your measurements. You had to measure the stream flow, the bank types, the soil types, and everything, and design the bridge. And the last thing you wanted to do was hike in 6 miles, do your work, hike back out, sit down at your desk that night, start drawing up, and find out you've forgotten one measurement, and have to hike back in the next day. That will ruin your whole weekend for you. And so what I'd do, I would sit down after I got everything measured that I needed to measure and do a rough drawing. Make sure I had all the measurements I needed. Make sure I had everything I needed. And then I'd leave. Well, it was during these times that I started seeing them. They get curious as to why I was there. Here's this human being sitting in the forest, 6 miles off the nearest road, drawing, and they had no idea why, you know, hadn't been anybody there in 400 years. So why is he there now type thing? And I'd catch him peeking around a tree at me. For a long time, I thought, you know, they only had one eye. I just shifted from side to side. I'd see it out this side of the tree, and I'd see it over on this side of the tree. So. And that's when it really started, really got real for me, because I could see what they were doing. And I mean, when you're hiking in and you step across a little no-name stream, there's a sandbar in the middle of it's a 15-inch track. That catches your attention. You know, nobody went in that far to make a fake track on the off chance that somebody might be there. When nobody had been there, like I say, in 400 years, this is old growth timber, 300, 400 year old stuff. And there's no animals under an old growth forest. There's no food for them. So there's just no reason to be there for hunters to be there, for the Indian peoples and such to be there. They're on the streams and along the open areas where the elk and the deer live. Not back in that country. So that caught my attention. And from there, it started growing. And then I started, you know, having experiences. One day I had a little logging company. And that's what the shirt says. On the eighth day, God created loggers. And the devil stood at attention. So, but we took a day off, my partner and I, my friend and I. He was a forester, a timber buyer, and I had my company, and I was shut down. It was fire season and couldn't work. So we took a day to go grouse hunting, which was our euphemism for being in the woods when the elk were bugling. If you've never been there, it's something you have to do in your lifetime. It is absolutely fantastic. Listen to those big bulls calling their cows. And we got on a herd, probably 100 animals. These are the Olympic elk, the Roosevelt elk, and they're the largest elk species in North America. And just comparison, Rocky Mountain elk, or Yellowstone bull, a large bull will be 700 pounds. An average Olympic bull is 1,200 pounds. And they're that much bigger. And it's just so much fun. Just use a cow call, and you get where you can walk right along with the herd. Just beep your little cow call, beep, beep, talk to them. And there's times you can reach out, touch a cow on one side, or reach out, touch a cow on the other side. It's just absolutely great. And we followed them for most of the day. Finally got them cornered, and broke up the herd. The herd bull was a big 5-point bull, and he was angry. He was standing out in the open ground just screaming his head off, and we decided that was probably close enough. We'd gotten as close as we wanted to him, and of course by that time we'd gotten separated, but no big deal. We both of us were foresters. We knew how to find our way out of the woods, and started back. And I noticed ahead of me a clearing, and in that country, a clearing generally means water. And if there's water, there's generally something nearby. So I decided to sneak in on it and see. Well, it turned out it wasn't water. It was an area of blowdown timber, about 5 or 6 acres of it. And I saw two bears feeding on the mushrooms on the blown down trees. So I decided to watch for a while. It's always fun to watch animals and when they don't know you're there. And the wind was from them to me, so I was in good shape. And I sneaked up behind the last big spruce tree there, about 8-9 foot diameter spruce tree, and just watched. And then one of them stood up, looked around. There was no bear. It didn't have a snout. It didn't have shoulders. It was very humanoid and about 7.5 to 8 feet tall. And he looked around very carefully, checked his surroundings, and squatted back down, started eating mushrooms again. Now, I was jealous because I love the oyster mushrooms you're eating. They're absolutely delicious. And you can pick them right off the trees they're growing on and eat them. They're great. Pardon me, they chose this moment to just mow the lawns outside. I haven't done it all winter, but they're going to do it today. So I sat there and I was transfixed then. I wasn't moving. I wasn't going anywhere. And then the other one stood up. It was a female. And looked around. Back down. This went on for 20, 30 minutes. I sat there watching, just observing, you know. And that's how you learn about things. You don't know what a Sasquatch is by seeing him cross the ridge a mile away or having him cross the road in front of you. It tells you nothing about them other than the fact they are. But when you can sit and do the Diane Fossey, Jane Goodall thing, observe them in their natural habitat, doing what they normally do, that's when you start learning. And that's what happened to me. I started learning. And about 20, 30 minutes into this, I felt a little gust of wind hit the back of my neck. And I knew I was busted. Immediately, four eyes went click right on me. And so I just stood up, stepped away from the tree. I wanted to see, you know, who I was and that I wasn't a threat to him. By this time, the female, he had stepped back and allowed her to go back into the standing timber. And as she started to move, she reached down and picked up an infant. So it was a family group. And she got back to the edge of the trees, and I told him, I said, thank you for sharing your family with me. And he turned around, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but to this day, I swear he nodded at me as he turned and left. He acknowledged what I said to him. That could be a daydream, but man, it sure looked like it. I'll carry that one to my grave. It was such a neat moment. And this was, you know, mid-1970s as this happened. And we went on like that all the way through the 70s, experiences like that, learning about them. I was an archer, and I bow hunted elk. And on one hunt, I got to watch two of them, actually three of them, had a youngster with them, fishing in some series of beaver dams up the creek. And they would run the salmon up next to the dam and pick him out. And as I watched him, the male, I could see the male very well. He was right in front of me, about 20 yards. And he'd pick up the salmon, of course, they're just flopping everywhere. And he'd squeeze them between his arm and his body. And some he'd keep, some he'd throw away, throw back. And I watched him for a long time there trying to figure out what his rationale was. Because obviously there was a reason, but why? You know, why would you keep some and not the other? Finally, I realized if he squeezed them and eggs or sperm came out, he kept them. They were fresh. But if nothing came out, that meant they were spawned out. And you know what spawn salmon do? They start to die immediately. They get a like cancer to their body. It just rot right on the bone. And Those were bad, so he threw them back, but he kept the fresh ones. And that was pretty informative.
Can I ask why so many researchers talk about them being so hard to find or be able to see? Like, it seems like I've heard people talk about that they feel like they have a layer of camouflage. And I'm sure there's many different opinions on Sasquatch. And I'm just interested, like, was it the specific area that you were at that you were able to get such close views of them?
Or? There were a lot of them in the area where I was, yes. The country, the Olympic Peninsula, the far northwest corner of Washington, and it was absolutely wonderful area for them. But I don't know. I was in the woods all the time. I mean, 24/7. If I wasn't working, then I was out either fishing or hunting or something like that. So I was there all the time. Also, I was there alone and in stealth. Okay. If I was bow hunting, of course, I'm totally in stealth. If I was doing my forestry work, I wasn't talking to anybody. You know, it was just me there. And that is a major key. Even as long as I researched, I went alone. I took my chair. I opened it up and I sat down and I waited. They get curious, which I learned in that first incident I was talking about. They'll come to you because they get curious as to why you're there. They want to know what you're doing. And they have to protect their area too. You know, they're good. And so you have to be alert to see them. Now, the two instances I talked about were I was lucky enough to see them before they saw me. Then I was able to just sit and observe. And like any wild creature, and they are, they're humanoid, but they're wild. They're very, very intelligent, but they're still a wild creature in all ways. And they get very curious and they want to know what's going on. They want to know and be in charge of what's in their area. So they're going to come, if there's something stranger, they're going to check it out. You have to be alert enough then to be able to see what they're seeing, to be able to see them. And that's a trick. When they're in the timber, they're very difficult to see because they generally are dark, although I've seen them from bright red hair to white, the same cut range of hair colors that we have. But normally speaking, they're dark or shades of dark. And that's very hard to pick up in shadows. The best camouflage pattern that you can buy, bar none, is something called ASAP, all season, all terrain. And it's not an oak leaf pattern or a maple leaf pattern. It's just a pattern of shadow patterns. And you will blend into anything with that. Okay, same thing there. That dark hair, especially if it's mixed with a little bit of light here and there just to break it up. And they're almost impossible to see unless you catch movement. And our eyes are subject to that anyway. You can look at a solid figure and not be able to see it at all until it moves. And other wild creatures are even more so. A bear is a prime example. I one time walked right down the middle of the road, seeing how close I could get to two bears. And I got within 30 feet of them. Walking right down the middle of the road. No camouflage. I mean, I'd come out of the woods, I was logging, and I'd come out of the woods to go to town to do something that day. And I've got my tin hat on, red suspenders and hickory shirt and blue jeans, and walking right down a gravel road. Take one step, two steps, and hold dead still. And they, of course, they feed, and then they'll look around, make sure their territory is clear. And they take another step or two and stop. It took me about a half an hour, but I got within 30, 35 feet of my rear desk.
Well, what were you able to learn about their living styles and their habits, or if they had anything
that
specific?
That probably came more later. I learned on that first instance that they live in family groups, okay? That they're not like the wild apes, the gorillas or the chimpanzees, where, you know, it's a hierarchy. There's a group of females and males visit them. No, they live in a family group, same as we do. Okay, and I've had that reinforced many times. But I know what we were talking about the, you know, if you want to really want to see them, find yourself a place, especially near water, that's alone. You can be alone, sit your tail down, open up your Kindle and read, drink a Diet Pepsi, and wait for them to come up, because they will. But you have to be able to see them. You've got to be sharp enough eyed to see. And that takes some work. That takes time. So you've got to be careful and you've got to learn to look. You've got to learn to look at what you're seeing. But at the same time, you're going to see fantastic things come before your eyes. I've sat there watching, waiting, and had wolves walk by me, not see me. I've had coyotes by the ton do that, and every other animal imaginable. That lived in the area. I've had cougar pass by me without seeing me. Just because I'm sitting there quietly. You know, they get, if you don't move, they have a great deal of trouble picking you up. Their eyes don't have as many rods as ours do. They aren't as sophisticated as our eyes are. And you know, the old adage is if a leaf falls in the forest, the deer will see it. The owl will see it. The deer will hear it, and the bear will smell it. They're the finest nose in the world is on a bear, but they don't see very well because their eyes are so ancient. And these guys, they have eyes pretty much like ours. They don't have the ultraviolet limiters that we have, the big yellow head that we have that eliminates ultraviolet, which means that's why we can't see at night, and they can. On night vision, night light is almost entirely ultraviolet light. And if you can't see ultraviolet light, you can't see at night, and that's us. But they can't. And we could just continue on. From there, we advanced further into these studies. And then we got to an area, 1978, I was bull bucking for a company down in Northern California as the person that runs the timber cutting crews. And as such, I had to, be places they didn't really want to be when I didn't want to be there, but it was part of the job. And I hated that job because all I did was keep people from working. They'd be cutting timber and I'd show up and they'd want to stop, talk, and now get back to work. But en route into the more central area of mountains of Northern California, I happened on a set of tracks one day, one morning early, and they crossed the road. And we had just cleared the road to get through. And in the slush and snow and ice that was left were a set of 14-inch tracks, crossed the road and went off and on down the hill. Well, I wanted to stop and follow them then, but when you got a $2 million logging job going on, you don't leave that to go chase Sasquatch and keep your job very long. So I went ahead and did what I had to do. And I was staying over there that night. Next morning, I came back and I got on those tracks. And I started following them down the mountain, down into the canyon bottom. I never did catch up with that track, but I was able to follow him about 8 miles. And again, learn their tracks. They're different than ours. They walk differently than we do. They walk with what's called a compliant gait. Okay. That means when they walk, their leg swings out to the side, comes forward, and lands flat-footed. We land with a heavy heel strike. So our track is going to be deepest where our heel hits. That's the highest pressure point. Theirs, they land flat. They have a mid-tarsal break in their foot. So when they step forward, that breaks, and all their weight's on the front half of their foot, as opposed to us, where our heaviest strike is the back. So their tracks are deeper in front than they are in the back. Quick way to learn them very quickly. It just stands right out, unless they're in a very difficult medium. But the first thing I did when I started learning tracks was to take my boots off and walk beside them and compare. Number one, I didn't sink near as far as they did. Number two, I couldn't step near as long as they did. To illustrate that point, I've taken a 50-foot length of rope, and I have the step lengths of the Patterson-Gimlin creature, Patty, and I marked that on that rope. And quite often at a conference or something, that I'll stretch that out and let people try to walk it. And it's a trip watching them try to do it. Normally you get this head bob that's tremendous that as they step.
How impactful was that film for, I mean, it's everybody knows it, it's iconic, but I've heard some researchers that don't really talk about it. They kind of just don't really try and
well,
look
they
at
don't
it at all.
Because it's a source of, you know, the haters want to hate it. But if you've been into that film at all, you know what it is. It is impossible to be faked.
It gives you goosebumps, I'll tell you that much.
Okay. The Bill Munns, who ran the school for creature creation in Hollywood, okay? He knows something about making costumes.
I'd hope so.
Huh?
I'd hope so, yeah.
Yes. And he has taken that film, not frame by frame, but layer by layer of emulsion within the frame, and broken it down, and has concluded, if no other reason, the proportions of the creature in it, it would be impossible to do. In 1967, everybody said it was impossible. John Chambers, who won the Academy Award for Planet of the Apes in 1968, said we didn't have material that would do what that did until the 1970s. But it stretches, it moves. You can see muscular movement under it. Yet, if you look at the spine, it indents where the spine is. Okay, that's just the skin. Look at the muscular movement. You can see her eyes blink. Okay, now let's get to proportions. There's something called intermembral index. It's the ratio of your arm length from shoulder to wrist to your leg length from hip to ankle. It's an anatomical constant. It's taught in anatomy 101. In us, that ratio is 72. In her, that ratio is 84. That cannot be duplicated. That cannot be imitated. Why? Because the ratio between the upper arm and the lower arm remains constant. If we put an extender, for me to go from an intermembral index of 72 to 84, I would have to put a 4-inch extension on my arm. Okay? I couldn't do it with an arm extender, because then my lower arm would be way out of proportion with my upper arm. The only way to do that would be to surgically insert 2 inches upper arm and 2 inches lower arm. And I'm not about to let that happen. Okay. Look at the head. And there's something that you might, if you want to verify this, go to Bill Munns' report on YouTube. And he has a whole series of reports that will go through these comparisons item by item, and he draws them out for you. If you took a human and tried to put it in a head shaped like that, it wouldn't fit. Because what's our eyebrows, what's our forehead do? Goes up. What's her forehead do? It goes back. They have that sagittal crest for that huge masseter muscle that controls the jaws. We don't have that. It could not possibly be a human in a suit, period.
And plus, if you really talk, if you really examine, like what you said, where you say her, mm-hmm. I mean, to think about faking something back then and then having the thought of making it a girl, it just that doesn't comply.
That doesn't ring true either.
Yeah.
And then the last thing about that, I know Bob Gimlin personally. The finer man never walked the face of this earth. He's a cowboy in the true sense of the word. What people have done to him over the last 50 some years, if it were 150 years ago, that'd have got him shot. You didn't call a cowboy a liar. You didn't question his veracity. And Bob's that type of man. He's just a small fellow. We stand together. I'm 6'4". He's about 5'6". six, something like that. And we kind of don't match that way, but we sure do the way we think. It's one of the most honest men I've ever met in my life.
What have you learned from examining the Bigfoots or Sasquatches that really kind of changed your perception on your initial research or interest into it?
Their intelligence.
Okay.
Number one, their intelligence. At first, I thought them. I was with Grover Krantz. They're an undiscovered North American ape that survived the Pleistocene. Until I got to where I was watching them, where I could see them. This picture behind me is our research area up in Canada. We did a 5-year study up there, and that's a couple of my partners with me, Sue and Randy Brisson. And in that area, we got to know the home clan very, very well. I mean, I was even at the birth of the daughter of the clan leader's twins. Now, I don't know another man in the world that can say he was ever present at the birth of twin Sasquatch. But sitting with 18 male Sasquatch attending the birth of babies was a thrill that I will never forget in my life, I guarantee you. But seeing, it was almost ritualistic. It was almost like a royal birth, what it was. But understanding their intelligence, the fact they could communicate with me. Okay. I started to tell the story of the group in Northern California. And that was before I knew how. But when I made camp that night after finding those tracks, I had a family of three visit me. I think I had usurped their bedding spot. It was a burned out hollow tree, big old fir tree that was burned out and hollow. And I just used it for a tent. And I noticed these black hairs inside of it when I went in, but I thought they were bear. And since this was May, I didn't think it'd be a problem. I'd be gone before a bear wanted to use it again. But I think I was there. And he was trying to communicate with me tremendously, and we just couldn't do it. But later I learned how. And I learned how in 2010, actually. And that was when I started learning. They are not just another dumb ape. These are a very intelligent humanoid individual. They're like us in many ways, but they're unlike us in many ways too. Okay. They are a fantastic type of people to be around. They are, if you respect them, they are not threatening whatsoever. But anybody is going to defend themselves. And any mother worth the name is going to do everything she can to protect her young. Have I ever gotten between a mother and her young or in the wrong place? Oh, yes, I have. And what did I do? I left. Excuse me, I didn't mean to do this. This is your home. I'm intruding. I'll leave and I'll come back and do my thing when you're done. I did it. Okay. At first, I started talking to them way back in the 70s, not ever thinking that they would understand me. And maybe they did, maybe they didn't, I don't know. But by the 2010s, yeah, they did. I knew they did. I gained a teacher, and he helped me to learn. And he's the source of the 13 books I've written on them. All that information came from him, through him.
Now, do they communicate through words, or is there...
That was the first time in my life I had ever experienced word speak or mind speak when I knew what it was. He was there and speaking to me in my mind. And, you know, we've all had mind speak. I believe everybody has. You may not call it the same thing. But an example, I was coming home one evening from a friend's house at dinner. Long straight stretch of road, and it was raining. It was February, and it was just absolutely pouring. And so I was just drifting along 45, 50 miles an hour. There was no traffic. And all of a sudden, I see this truck coming up behind me at a very high rate of speed. He passed me doing probably 80, 85 miles an hour. And it was four high school kids in this pickup truck, all with Letterman jackets from nearby town. They'd had a basketball game in the other town and were headed home. And I just saw them coming. I just pulled off the edge and let them go by and started to pull back on. And the boy says, slow down. They're not going to make the curve. So I creeped around that curve. I mean, I did not want to go around that curve because I knew what I was going to see and I did not want to see it. But I did. And fortunately, they just hit the infield on the access ramp to the freeway and it spun out and didn't roll. And I stopped and they were shaking, but they were all right. And that's an example of mind speak. Cliff Berrickman says mind speak's just a combination of self-talk and wishful thinking. Okay, where's the self-talk there? Where's the wishful thinking there?
Yeah.
No, that's not. That's mind speak. He was doing the same thing. It was a different voice. That was the only difference. It was a different voice and different message. And that's how he communicates with me even to today. When he wants me to do something for them, I'll hear about it.
How did you get to the point where you were open to hearing it the first time? I mean, open to hearing it in the 2010s compared to not being able to hear it before.
I think I got older and I got more serene and I wasn't so convinced of my own rightness.
Full of that young vinegar that all us kids are filled with.
Yeah, as men are, that's why women are better researchers than men. They don't have that ego.
We're trying our best, man. I'm really trying.
I know, but it's hard to do. We're male.
I know.
We have that protective instinct. We have that. We know best. We're going to get it done. Instinct.
I've never read instructions my entire life.
Yeah, but that's what. And I had to wait till I was 70 years old before that would work. You know, and I had to be. I was fully retired by then. They forced me to retire medically when I was about 63. And 62, something like that. And doctor says, I want you to retire from work. And I says, I don't want to retire. I had a job I loved. And absolutely loved going to work. I didn't want to quit. He says, let me rephrase that. If you do not retire from work this month, we will bury you next month. He got my attention. Okay. And so I had to retire. And when I first retired, I didn't have much income, just, you know, and had Social Security was all. And so all I could do was go out and find a place in the woods and sit. And since I'd been doing that quite a bit, it came kind of second nature, but it also gave me time to reflect and to think. And okay, my way hasn't worked. Let's try it your way type thing. And I just sit and think, meditate. And that's when it started happening.
Can I ask what the birth of the two twins was like? That sounds very interesting.
Oh, that was fantastic. Her mother, Rajase was a young lady's name. But Rajase's mother was in attendance. There were 18 male Sasquatch and me sitting watching this happen. Okay. We're in the woods and there's a stream. And as the baby is birthed, the first thing to do is took it to the stream and washed it. Okay. They made it all. Oh, did he squeal? same effect as the baby, or the doctor holding the baby up and swatting his butt. Same effect. Gets the lungs working. And I watched the baby being born, and it was a girl. And I thought that was it. And she went back to attend to Rajase again. And I couldn't figure out what's going on. All of a sudden, hey, it's twins. And she birthed the second one and took it down to the stream and washed it. And immediately put each one of them to a breast. And they, of course, they calmed right down and started eating. But that was so fantastic. And that was in the area And that with the picture that's behind me and there out in the backwoods of BC. From the last road, this is a provincial park. And the last road goes in, or the road goes in about 8 miles into the park. The next paved road from there is 125 miles away. If that gives you any idea of the country.
A long hike.
Yeah, long hike. Lots of nothing there. Huge mountains.
Ring trail mix.
Yeah. Block folded mountains. One comes up, then the other one next to it, and big canyon in between. And southern British Columbia has a lot of block folded mountains. And that's where we did a 5-year study on their written language in this area. And as you can see by the soil cover there, that's all moss. It was absolutely great for this type of study because when they made their glyphs, we could find them, you know, weeks later, actually, if they weren't destroyed. But
can I ask about their glyphs? Because I'd like to know more about their habitats, like how, because I've heard people say that, like, and I've heard stacking rocks was a sign that one was in an area. I don't know if that's true or if you...
that is true, but that's much more difficult to authenticate than the glyphs are. But the glyphs are difficult to authenticate as well. The rock stacks, the reason they're hard, so hard is because people do that too a lot.
I do a lot and I take pictures. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't help it. It's cool.
You can, yeah. But you kind of have to know where you are and you look for other signs. And one of my favorite signs is a footprint about that long right in the middle of it. If you look over my shoulder, you'll see there, if I can get out of the way, what we're standing at there is a glyph. And that's it's a asterisk, 6-point asterisk. I can't get my other fingers to do it. But at any rate, like yay. Okay. And what that is, we had been asked to demolish that. What that is, it was a sign. It was an altar area for them. Those elements in that glyph, the bottom element, the bottom stick, was totally covered with moss. The second one, the middle one, was about half colored with moss, and the top one had no moss on it at all. And what that is, it's a sign of the evolution of the growth, okay, of the transition from the old, the intermediate, to the new. And another thing they do in that area a lot is use sword ferns. And that area, I don't know if you can see them, there's lots of sword ferns around that. Plus the fact there's a set of 15-inch tracks that goes right across the middle of it with a 51-inch stride. Okay. And we were asked to demolish that because it's in right next to a campground practically.
Do you believe that's on purpose, that the government and other business people know about that these are certain signs? And
we talked to the park rangers in this area many times because they knew we were doing research and they'd come see how it was going. And tons of structures built in here with logs. Well, being a park, everything's supposed to be stay where natural where it is. So they'd come in, the park rangers would come in the next morning and tear that down. Spend all day tearing their structure down. Come back the next morning, it's back again. they just gave up on it. they knew what was going on. And everyone there had seen them at one time or another. And because they, like I say, this where we are right here is within 100 yards of a campground. It was closed at that time, but it's open in the summertime. And that's why they wanted that removed, because it had gotten too popular with people. And so they asked us to take it down.
Do you believe the government has more information on them that maybe they might
have let
on? I'm
sure they do. I know within the Forest Service, there isn't a forester out there that doesn't have proof or doesn't have sightings, but you don't take it back to the office. Okay. Ever since Paul Freeman, you just don't take it back to the office. The government doesn't want anything to do with it because they don't want to have to take ownership. Okay. And that's a good thing. Because what has our government ever done good for indigenous people?
They just meddle.
Yeah. Yeah. The first thing you'd know, it'd be the first step on their road to extinction. Because the first thing you'd know, here'd be the special interest groups trying to close all forested areas. Everything the government owns would be off limits to people entirely. Well, that's going to create a backlog, just like the spotted owl did with the garbage they did there. And a huge backlog. There are going to be people out shooting them just to get rid of them so they aren't there. It'd be tragic. It'd be horrible if the government ever had to take control. Milton Friedman, economist for like four different presidents, said, if you put our government in charge of the Sahara Desert, in 5 years, there'd be a worldwide shortage of sand.
That's so true.
And that's the truth. It really is. So the last thing I ever want them is proven to the government. Does the government know about them? Yeah, they do. I mean, they've been in the Bureau of Land Management. In their brochure, talks about them. Have for years. The military, Fort Lewis, Washington, huge military base. Then there's night orders for the sentries of what to do if they come on one. Yeah, so they know they're there. They know what they are. They just don't want to have to admit it. Look at what they did with how long did they stonewall UFOs?
Yeah.
You know, from the 40s. Yeah.
Could I ask, out of all your experiences that you've had, have you ever had a negative encounter with one of these?
Never. Never. Never? No. Have I, like I said, have they been angry with me because I was there? Yes. I apologized and I left. I can tell you another anecdote happened in Oregon, near Portland, Mamaluce Lake area. I have some friends, two ladies, that like to camp, and they came back with a tale. They had been really scared that night. And I said, do you want me to come out and see what's going on? Said, yes, would you please? So I went and spent a weekend with him. And he came in about 2 a.m., and he was upset. But I knew why. We had spent that day. This is the first U.S. National Forest next to the city of Portland. And it was trashed. There were tires laying in creeks. There were car batteries laying in creeks. We filled our truck with trash out of the creeks and stuff. And this fellow was upset at the way the land was being treated. No respect. No respect at all. The first thing my teacher taught me, he said, I don't understand humans. They have no respect. They don't respect the land where they live. They don't respect one another. And most tragic of all, they don't even respect themselves. And he's totally right. We're disrespectful creatures as a group. And he came in that night, like I said, 2 a.m., and was angry. And I started talking to him. What's the problem? Why? Well, look at before you get angry with us, look at our truck. That there are, you know, that's what we've been doing all day, is cleaning up as much as we could. We're only one little group of people. And he calmed down then. So, yes, they do get upset. And like I said, if you threaten one of those groups of Honobi massacre or something like that. One of those anyway down there. We fired 17 shots. The first thing we saw one. Well, I think that would irritate me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody started shooting me. They get upset. But as a rule, they're totally benevolent. If you're trying to remain hidden from society, the last thing you're going to do is attack that society. You know, there's nothing guaranteed to bring retribution faster than that. Okay, so it just doesn't make sense to want to attack people. Now, that said, there are many of them that wish we'd just fall off the end of the earth and disappear. You know, sometimes I have days like that myself. I understand totally. And since I've come to know them, I much prefer to be with them than most people anyway. We have our research group that I just absolutely love. But I'm old now and I can't get out. You know, I can't camp. When we have our camps, I can, if they're close enough, I can go for the day and have to come back home at night. But when the body was there, I was there, you know. But that's not to be anymore. So now, well, actually, as of 2010, my chore became to tell their story. That's what he wanted. That's what he recruited me for. That's why I've written 13 books and got another one in the thought stage right now. Hope I have time to finish it. I'm helping Barb shoot. Squashing with Barb and Gabby, or Barb and Goldie now. Helping her write a book. I'm helping Arla Collette write a book. So I still have some function, but I can't do now what I did then.
How difficult is it for you to share your experiences besides writing about it, but just sharing it around? Cause you have so much amazing, I love the answer, but you have so many experiences that it must get frustrating to be able to sort out which ones to be able to talk about.
It is, because you've got to judge your audience. There's some people would be insulted by what I've told you so far, especially about the watching the birth of the babies.
Yeah, it's why I'm light treading the topic, because I've noticed that there's a large divide amongst researchers.
But the difference is I don't care. I tell what I saw as I saw it. Now, you may see something, watch something, the same thing I'm watching, and get a totally different take from it, because your experiences are different than mine. And we are a product of our experiences. And we see things as a result of the product of those experiences. So when I see something, when I report something, it's strictly as I saw it, as I interpreted it. That doesn't mean everybody's going to interpret it the same way. Okay, and I understand that. I fully understand that. The difference between me and that hater is that when I hear something that I haven't experienced or sounds strange to me, I put it over here on the shelf until it does happen. Okay. An example of that, back in 2010, I was at my first conference ever. I had gone to Toby Johnson, his conference, Oregon Sasquatch Symposium in Eugene, Oregon. And a lady there, Autumn Williams, I don't know if you know Autumn. She had a TV show for a year, a neat little lady. She ran Oregon Sasquatch group. And Autumn's mother had written a book. And she was talking about watching tracks appear crossing a field with nothing making them. You know, she couldn't see anything making them, but the tracks were appearing across a plowed wheat field. And at the break, I had probably a dozen people come up to me. Is that true? Does that happen? And I said, you know, not going to deny it, but that's not my experience. I haven't had that experience. That's Kathy, or yes, Sally. That's her experience. I just, you know, have to talk to her. In the meantime, I just let it be. And it was the following spring, early spring, Dr. Igor Berchtesgadeff was over from Russia, and I was hosting him for a few days. And as such, took him to a young man he wanted to meet out in McMinnville, Oregon. And we went up to his research area. And I had some stuff I had to catch up on. And they wanted to do a hike up the river, and I wanted them just to go alone and have that experience. I said, I'll just stay here at the car and get done what I need to do. And I put out a bag of apples, 21 apples, made a pyramid out of them, one of the big flat rocks. Just sat in my car and I was ready. First thing you knew, I went sound asleep. I mean, sound asleep. And woke up a while later, and there were 5 apples left. And I got out of my car, I was going to take pictures of it. My camera wouldn't work. Battery was dead. And so I walked over to the edge of the bank, looked down, and there's this little wet swale down below there with brush growing. And what do I see? 2 sets of tracks side by side appearing in that mud. I said, boy, I'm glad I didn't say that was impossible. So keep an open mind. Even if something that sounds totally ridiculous, keep an open mind. Some of the ladies here were talking about seeing fairies. Now, that was so foreign to me that, you know, but I said, okay, that's what you saw. Then Barb comes in with video, taking whatever that thing was. And when you slow it down, it looks all for the world like a freaking fairy. In January, and it covered 140 feet in 0.4 seconds. That's over 200 miles an hour. What was it? And Barb has the video if you want to see it. It's on her channel on YouTube.
Yeah, just forward me a link to that. I'd like to check that out.
Yeah.
Tom, I appreciate the work that you have done. I'm going to have you come back on here when I can think of some good stories I got to get from you. I'm sure there's a billion in your head that I just got to find the right route to. But is there a place?
You remind me and they pop back. You know?
Is there a place where people can find your books, your website, any other links you'd like
just
to promote?
My website is easy to remember. See my name? Put a .com after it.
That's a genius promotion right there.
Okay. I started out with the name of my first book, ghostsofrubyridge.com. But by the time I had written 10 books, the name of that website was so long. I decided just to go with my name and then I could have them. Yeah. And you can order them directly from me there. They come to you signed that way. You can also get them on Amazon, but that's not any fun. And, one of the greatest rewards of writing a book is being able to sign it for people. You know, I never knew that at the time. Yeah. And the other one, your payment for it, it's not monetary. I mean, I make enough off selling books to pay for the ones I give away. You know how that goes. And it gets me to a conference now and again. That's about all of it does. But I do need to sell some because I need to get to some conferences this year. And so I'd really appreciate it if people would go to my website and do that. But what was I going to say? That's the trouble with being old. You know, somebody mentioned a song the other day from 1957. And I went through the lyrics of it like it was brand new, but I couldn't remember what I had for breakfast, you know?
I think I can't even remember half the time what I've had for breakfast, so don't feel bad.
Oh, but I don't even remember what we're talking about now.
Well, Tom, you've given me enough of your time, man. I'm going to actually link your links in the description for people to be able to click and check out your website. Yeah.
How to find me. Yeah, it's I'm on Facebook under my own name, TomCantrell.com or Amazon. There's at my website, there's lots of articles there and other essays that I've written. Some about Sasquatch, some about other things, because I have other interests too. But mainly, my life has been Sasquatch for 65 years, and especially for the last 15.
Well, a life it's been, right?
Yeah, life.
Plenty of new stories to make as well, too.
Yes, absolutely. We've only scratched the surface.
I'm going to link all your links in the description. It'll be a pleasure to have you back on the show at some point. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank, and stay tuned for our next episode.